God, we thank you that you always meet us right where we are, right at our point of need. And as you do, you always have something waiting for us, whatever it is. Lord, sometimes we realize what it is we need, and you meet it, and we're able to say thank you so quickly. And then there's other times that you meet us at our point of need with something unexpected. And as we walk away from that moment, or as we think back on it, we recognize how what you did was so much more, so much bigger, so much better than we ever dared hope for. Well, I pray that this would be a day that as we study together, as we worship, as we celebrate, that at our point of need, whatever it is, we would not only find you, but we would celebrate you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. This morning, we continue our Understanding the News series, where we are looking this time at what we called WWT, or World War III, or World War Against Terrorism, whatever you want to call it. Been one of those mornings, so I didn't get in here to put up the big review. But what we have been doing is moving through and looking at terrorism, ISIS in particular, as we know it, from trying to understand it from a biblical perspective. And so along the way, we have very quickly kind of talked about a number of things. And I said that there is a great potential, great possibility to hear any of these Understanding the News studies. And we immediately begin putting the filter on that we listen to our news through. We immediately put the filter on and we start processing the world through. And that doesn't always help us. And so the idea is to shift just a little bit and come back and put a biblical filter on what it is that we hear, what it is that we see. And we did that by looking at the Israeli-Arab crisis. We talked about the Russian Revolution, which, of course, we still have one session left to do that we'll try to get there and fulfill that prophecy that's looming out there. And we also then have been talking, in particular this time, about ISIS. And we last time, if I'm remembering correctly, we were able to go back through and give you the kind of the biblical history of how we got to this moment in history. In other words, where it starts, and we started with Abraham, we went all the way back to Abraham and talked about this controversy that has been just bubbling through the years. It's not new, but yet at the same time, it is very much a part of our global stage. And it will continue to be, by the way. This past week, I told you, someone emailed me as soon as I saw this, and I don't know if you saw this or not, but as we were talking about a variety of things, excuse me, Russia has said that as of last Friday, that it has killed ISIS leader al-Baghdadi and other leaders in a strike in late May. Baghdadi was the world's most wanted man, if that's true, because he is the official leader, recognized leader, of ISIS at its time. The United States has not been able to confirm that report, but apparently he was killed in a Russian airstrike in late May. At least that's what they are saying. And he was also killed along with 30 mid-level militant leaders and 300 other fighters as they are continuing the press to see if they can move ISIS out of Raqqa, which is the group's capital. He had a $25 million reward on him. Whether or not he has been killed or not, we'll wait and see. But if you remember, we talked last time about the fact that one of the mistakes that we have made, at least when we understand ISIS, is that when you kill the leader, it's over. And you remember if you're with us. And we equated that to an assassination of a president. You know, we talked about the fact that, you know, that things start happening behind the scenes, but that doesn't kill the movement. And so for people to try to understand that beating ISIS for many people was as simple as killing Osama bin Laden, because that was payback for 9/11. So, hey, we won. Al-Zarqawi, when he was killed. Okay, we won. We killed their leader. Al-Baghdadi. While it is important, and it is certainly strategically, if you're in the military end of this thing, is exactly what you want to do. It just means there is another leader. You haven't killed the movement. There's just another leader that comes up seventh place. But yet a miscalculation that many people do when they listen to the news is, well, once the leader's gone, I mean, these bunch of nomad wanderers are just going to disband and run for what? The hills? They live in the hills. I mean, you know, and we have lived in a culture that has miscalculated how to defeat ISIS now for the past, 16 years. And part of what happened, and someone made this observation offline to me, is that we were just, as a nation, completely unprepared for September 11th because we just honestly believed it just couldn't happen. And when the unbelievable happens, what you do in the aftermath of that becomes wildly important. And so what's happened in our history, at least as a nation, is we have now dealt with the aftermath of that in a variety of ways. And you know, we probably have learned some lessons well and probably not learned some lessons well, depending on who you are and what you think and how you're wired and who you listen to. But that's kind of where we are. And so we come back again, and we begin today, and I think we left off last time kind of doing a description of ISIS so we could understand it. And so we'll pick up there. We've covered a whole lot of other things. So let me give you a brief profile of the Islamic State, IS, ISIS, if you will, that will at least help you put something about, when you hear about them, understanding what it is, okay? And maybe that will help. Within the framework of Islam, the mission of ISIS is to take the Muslims worldwide back to the Quran to restore the purity of the religious teachings of Muhammad, the teachings that he received from Allah and recorded for the faithful. Second to the Quran, as a source of instructions, are the record of Muhammad's teachings and activities during his tenure as caliph of Islam. And so the hadith, or hadith, depending on where you're from. If you're from the deep south, it's hadith. Hadith is a collection based on the oral teachings of Muhammad that had been recorded, and it illuminates the doctrines. And so think of it as a commentary, okay, plus some other thoughts. Okay, so it's the Quran as Muhammad believed it, taught it, plus his commentary on it, and then the other piece that you want to add to this and understanding it is it's the application that he made to the world that he lived in. And all of that's really important because for someone from a Muslim background that is all in, both of these hold equal value. And so this would be like in Baptist, like poor analogy, but it's as close as I can get. I believe the Bible and the purpose-driven life. And the reason for purpose-driven life is because that's next to the Bible. That is the biggest Christian-selling book of all time. So then it would be someone saying, yes, it's the Bible, which is we believe is the Word of God, plus Rick Warren, who is America's pastor, and what he thinks about it, how he's applied it, the insights he's learned from it. These have just as much value. That's the Bible. In Christian circles, when it comes to theology, see, this is where you get in real sketchy territory, but this is where you hear folks, and you hear televangelists doing this all the time, by the way. So, I mean, this is not, don't think, you, when I say this about this is what Islam holds to, don't think this is wacky. Christians hold this kind of wackiness, too. They're not that kind of wacky, but just different kind of wacky, where they add to the Bible. Because I can guarantee you, give me an hour, I can come back with a quote from somebody on Christian television right now that is getting an extra biblical revelation from God. There are some denominations that happens all the time on a daily basis. And they have more clout with the extra biblical revelation than it does with the Bible. But I also would say to you, and boy, I'm going to drop this bomb and then walk away. I would also say to you, it is just not just other denominations do it. The predominant Southern Baptist author in America that everyone buys their Bible studies is known for extra biblical revelations. It's always dropping a bombshell in the middle of a Bible study somewhere, and then Baptists fight over it. Lifeway's biggest cash cow is notorious for this. And if you mention it, people want to fight you on it. So I'm not going to mention a name. I'll let you figure it out for yourself, and you go digging all you want for it. But the caution is, pay attention to what you read. Don't just assume that it's always right. Check it. Check it biblically. And that's even in conservative circles. So now take that as the illustration to understand that ISIS teachings then embrace not only the Quran, but an ancient commentator who applied it. And to understand the Quran, and of course, if Allah gave it to Muhammad, if Allah has spoken to Muhammad, that application becomes wildly important. And that serves as the background. And if you remember, at the Islam study we went to, especially that first night, they were throwing so much information so fast, but this is one of the things they kept harping on. You know, because people will often quote the Quran, but they often ignore some of the other teachings that are added to it that carry just as much clout, just as important. But that's the teachings. And so all Muslims embrace both, but in varying ways. Modern Muslims de-emphasize the teaching prescribing jihad against infidels, hatred of Jews and Christians, subjugation of women, overly strict lifestyle regulations, but not ISIS. As we talked about last time, ISIS is a group who hold on to and embrace Islam, that have taken and embraced Islam, and imagine, if you will, going back then to a first century, or first millennium, going back to just an ancient time and trying to do that in modern culture. And the illustration I used for you last week was, what if somebody showed up in Winter Springs Town Square and started sacrificing animals on an altar? And they say, well, that's what I'm doing. I'm just holding on to old Jewish traditional thought. And we say, you are extreme. Yes, you would be. And you also would be arrested for animal cruelty. Because you just can't go down there outside of Huey Magoo's and sacrifice a lamb. Not going to happen, right?
Or a chicken.
Well, a chicken, yeah. Chicken's allowed because we eat it inside. But neither here nor there, the lamb. You know, we don't do lamb tenders there. So, I mean, we would all look at that and go, that's wacky. But that's what this is. I mean, that's how you get it. You have to frame how you understand what's going on. So now you have a group of people holding on to a religious belief system that are now fleshing that out culturally in a quote-unquote modern-day world, as they would have done back in days that most of us don't even want to think about. And if you can get that, you understand then that the teaching they're basing it on is based on the Quran and the additional insights and the commentary offered by Muhammad. In September 10, 2014, President Obama made this statement: ISIL is not Islamic. No religion condones the killing of innocents, and the vast majority of ISIL's victims have been Muslims, and that's true. ISIL is a terrorist organization, pure and simple. Unfortunately, that statement, ISIL is not Islamic, is incorrect. We talked about that a little bit last week. Regardless of what anybody says, what any commentator, anybody that's going to write on the subject, ISIL thinks it's Islamic. And they are. Now, and we talked about what that means and how that plays out. Understanding that when it comes to ISIS traditions, although the vast majority of modern Muslims don't support ISIS, ISIS has gone back to a 7th century foundation, and they want to follow it in exact form, to the letter. In following Muhammad's example to the letter, ISIS is, in its purest form, the organizational expression of Islam. They are out to eliminate infidels. And an infidel is anyone who does not want to ascribe to and believe Islamic thought. The tradition, you've heard it said, Islam is a religion of peace. It's not found in the writings of the Quran, and it's not found in the teachings of Muhammad. As a matter of fact, in the last 9 years of Muhammad's life, he participated in 86 battles, 9 times a year. He is declaring war and is in warfare with someone else. And so the claim that Islam means peace is not accurate. Islam means surrender. That's the meaning of the word. At least it was understood in Muhammad's time. And so peace for Islam is what occurs after enemies lay down their arms in the face of violent jihad. That's the tradition it comes from. Now again, no, go back though to the statement I made as we started that little bit there. Modern Muslims don't embrace the violent end of jihad, but yet it is very much a part of the teaching and the background and the mindset. And so that's what you hear, that's what's happening with ISIS today. That's who they are. That is the enemy that we are fighting on a battlefield of terrorism, among others, by the way. And we talked about those last week, too. ISIS does not have an air force, doesn't have a navy, but it does have an army of tens of thousands of soldiers. In an open war against a nation's military, a developed nation's military, they wouldn't last long. But against armed civilians in sandals, unarmed villagers fleeing with children and household goods in hand, they're tough. And that's who they want to fight, by the way. I mean, that's the nature of the battle. The military training of ISIS is good, but the indoctrination that precedes it is what makes ISIS such a threat to the civilized world today. And this is where a lot of times you hear people talking on the news about ISIS and what you have to do with them. So let me kind of break down how ISIS trains as we try to understand them, and then we get ultimately to the takeaway of what do you do? I mean, how can you process this biblically? Let's talk about the training of adults. No Islamic community is without its mosque and community centers, but where ISIS is running things, like in Syria and Raqqa, those institutions become hotbeds of indoctrination, radicalization, and recruitment. It teaches a brand of Sunnite theology to adults and children outside of those centers in those rough areas. ISIS enforcers walk the streets with automatic weapons to impose strict adherence to Sharia law. Diet, dress, business dealings, music, everything is subject to correction and inspection. Think of it this way. Life under ISIS is closed. It's a controlled system where every aspect is part of the training. The training of children, male children especially, it centers on close teachings to the original teaching of Quran. Preteen boys are recruited into what they call caliphate clubs. It's not the Boys Club of America, but they become part of caliphate clubs to begin training to be ISIS Army of the Future. They pay the parents of the boys to let them do this, between $250 and $350 per month per child. They show these young teens ISIS videos of ISIS doing what they do, ISIS exploits, ISIS at war, ISIS in execution mode. They play video games, and in the video games, ISIS always wins. It's part of the indoctrination process. The boys then are sent to Sharia camps, and they're indoctrinated in Sharia law and ISIS ideology, where they swear loyalty to the leader of ISIS at the time, and the leader of the Islamic nation, the caliph, which up to this point had been al-Baghdadi, and if he's not there, then there's another one. And they swear allegiance to that one. And then they move them into military barracks, and they start living as teenagers, where they begin physical military training in a military barracks, just like you would if you were part of an army somewhere. In addition to infusing skill in the art of warfare, training includes cutting off the heads of dolls, carrying around the actual decapitated heads of ISIS victims, and anything else that can be done to desensitize trainees against what they will be called upon to do as ISIS soldiers. That's the indoctrination process. Boys who excel in physical and military skills are sent to combat. Those without the greater skill set are sent on suicide missions. That's what they do. They communicate as spies back and as informants against their own people. They become operatives in a version of a police state similar to Saddam Hussein's Iraq. And they report to anyone who speaks or acts against ISIS, violates Sharia law. parents live in fear of their own sons, whose loyalty to ISIS becomes greater than their family ties. But again, I mean, that's part of the indoctrination process. Child soldiering, by the way, just so you know, it is a violation of international law. You know, we would not put children at war in the United States. But again, you know, ISIS isn't playing by those rules. I mean, this is not the Geneva Convention rules that we're playing under here. It is that great analogy that we used a couple weeks ago. Well, the war is over. We are ceasing military activity. We are done with ISIS. Okay. And that's great. But what do you do if ISIS isn't done with you? I mean, Jim and I can be in a fight, and I can say, Jim, I'm not fighting you. Jim says, that's great. Don't fight me. And they keep pounding at me, right? No, Jim, our war's over. We're done fighting. Yeah, that's great. We are. Yes, we're not at war. As he beats me up. I mean, is that crazy? Is that insanity? But it's that mindset. You know. And it's also the mindset that goes as far as, well, if I just love Jim more, he'll quit hitting me. Sure he will. You have siblings close in age? Did that work? No. I'll just be nice to them. They'll quit picking on me. Sure they will. Of course they will. That makes great sense. You know who likes that one best? The one who didn't make that decision. Right? I mean, and so because, again, you're fighting a group where the thought is, how could they do that? Well, they've been taught to do that. That's what they've been taught to be. And so when you hear the reports, when you see the videos, you see the pictures, whatever, I mean, that is what they have been taught to be, trained to be. That is the training of children into adulthood. The tactics you're somewhat familiar with, the tactics are very similar to those originated by Muhammad and his successors in the first two centuries of Islam. Conquer, plunder, suppress. By conversion, taxation, death, and rule. ISIS has a goal, which is worldwide Islamic caliphate based on Sharia law. It's global domination. They don't want Raqqa. They don't want a little chunk of the Middle East. They just don't want Israel, by the way. You know, they want America. And I mean, because it is a desire to rule the world, and anybody that stands opposite of what you believe or what you want is your enemy. And so for America to understand ISIS, it's almost a foreign way to think for us that someone doesn't like us because of the things that we have, the things that we get to do, the freedoms that we have. You know, for us as followers, you know, we know that so many of these things are blessings that we have. Those blessings are why we're hated. How we use those blessings is an affront to the religious belief system that runs and rules the heart of a Muslim. And so to process ISIS at all without some understanding of Islam is impossible. Which also means that if you try to enter a strategy where you could ever defeat ISIS without understanding Islam, or some level of what it is that has gone into making who they are, it's impossible as well. And so when you hear the fact that we are in a worldwide war against terror, when we are fighting global terror, when you hear the news reports of how nations react to this and nations react to this and what's happening here and what's happening here, understand that the Muslim community, the Islamic community as it is in the world today, I mean, there has to be an understanding of what it is that they have been through, what it is they have come, where it is they have come from, and what it is they believe and embrace to understand this is the enemy that we are fighting. There is a religious connotation to this war. Simply stated, the United States is at war, and we've never officially declared it a war. It's been declared by presidents as a war. Most people think we're at war at some level, but then a lot of people think we're not. We just fight. But there is a war that's going on, and war has been declared on not only us but the entire world by a movement that is a religious movement at the heart of what it is. You can call it whatever you want, but that's what's going on at the other end of it. And understanding that, that it comes from a place that has its roots in the book of Genesis, means that this is a battle that has been brewing and has brewed and been fought really from the beginning of time, as we understand it. And now it continues to overflow that into the modern day world. It opens up, in some ways it opens up the old proverbial Pandora's box, because again, we always do come back to the lens that we view things in, right? And our comfort levels. Sometimes we're good, sometimes we're not good. But understanding that this is who we're after, see, we're fighting an enemy, and for us, we look at it and we just go, that's just pure evil. It is. You're right, it is. It is pure evil. But it is an evil that is born in a religious belief system that allows them to do what they do, minus a conscience, minus any guilt, minus any rationale or reason. That's the enemy. Jesus taught us in Matthew 6:10 to pray for two outcomes: your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And we know that, right? And those two outcomes converge in the second coming of Jesus and the establishment of his millennial kingdom of righteousness on earth. I mean, does the kingdom come now? Your will be done here as it is in heaven. And one day, someday, that all comes together. Surprisingly, for many, Islam has a similar pattern. They are looking for the return of the Mahdi, their Messiah, and his rule over a worldwide kingdom, caliphate, based on Sharia law. I mean, that ultimately is what they want. And you say, well, why is that? Well, again, this is, if you want to study world religion and stuff, Christian theology serves as a paradigm for most other religions as they come along. I mean, they borrow from the tenets of Judeo-Christianity. And so that's why the stories can be so similar. That's why so often what you hear is just a variation of. But ultimately, that's where that's where Islamic eschatology takes us. So uninformed people say this: see, Christians and Muslims believe the same thing, except we have a different king and a different kingdom. So it's not the same thing. But again, there are a lot of people that say, well, you just believe in God and do good things and, you're in heaven. No, that's not what he says. But that's the way people think. And so, as a result, we live now in a world where there has been a revival of the caliphate, which is that kingdom now is being established, and it's going to expand and it's going to spread. If al-Baghdadi is dead, according to their prophecy, there are four more caliphs that will come along before the Messiah returns. So what you're not going to hear in the news is, if al-Baghdadi is dead, for ISIS, he had to die because there's another caliph that has to come along. I mean, it has to come along, which brings him closer to the return of the Messiah. So in other words, his death furthers the cause, because he died in a holy battle. He died in a holy war. This fits the motif. This fits the methodology. This fits into what happened. That's why when the news report at the end of the week came out, and I was actually driving my car and I heard, I thought, I have to go back and count now. Because he, you know, and they've numbered them. I forget what their numbers are, but they've numbered who has been the leader, who's been the recognized leader. And so now there are four more that should be lining up before they get to the 12th. And when the 12th arrives, that is what ushers in the worldwide caliph. Worldwide domination is complete. And so ISIS doesn't mind the fact that the world is at war with them. They don't mind the fact that there are nations that are standing opposite them. There's a battle that they want to fight, because in fighting the battle and in fighting the holy wars, they get closer and closer to the day that they usher in that worldwide global kingdom. And that's extremely foreign to us. I mean, you know, that's just nowhere in our conventional, rational, you know, love everybody, live and let live, you know. That doesn't fit anywhere into our mindsets. But yet for them, if the report is there was one killed in May and a new leader will emerge, that just moves them closer to that end game. And both now and in the future, the Islamic Caliphate will be governed by Sharia law. Sharia, and you hear a lot about that, it holds the teachings of the Quran, the Hadith, and accepted authorities and other commentators throughout the centuries. And it's applied on contextual and case-by-case cases in Sharia courts. And you hear about that. You hear about other nations of the world that have communities that live under Sharia law. And there's nothing, if you're a woman, Sharia law is not your thing. If you choose an alternative lifestyle, Sharia law is not your thing. And sometimes, in understanding and trying to understand, I mean, I'll listen to news reports and I just think to myself, what are you saying? As someone starts talking about the world that we live in, because sometimes they defend the right to have Sharia law even happen in America. And some of the defenders of it would not be allowed to live if we lived under Sharia law, which is the insanity of it, which just basically means they're ignorant. You know, they're either ignorant of what it really is, or they're just ignorant. Because if you know what something is and you don't do anything about it, then now we're back to being ignorant again. So there's levels of ignorance, right? You know,
I thought ignorance was not understanding. You just said if they understand it, and still that's just stupidity.
Well, I was about to crack on the fact that since his father's day, my mom's here, my dad, I remember my dad telling me, there are a lot of levels of stupidity. Yeah, I remember him telling me that on a number of occasions, and there's great wisdom in that. You know, there are levels of stupidity. That is stupid. I mean, it is. I mean, and that's the S word you don't want to use with your kids, but yeah, oh yeah, that's out there. And there is a day where, for them, the return of the Messiah is what they're moving toward, and so this past week's events, as they were announced, that they really did happen in May, and of course, and now here we are in June, right? So, you know, word doesn't travel quickly as we think it is, where worldwide communication is instant, it seems, right? But so if Russia did do this in May, you can go back into May then and try to figure out what has happened in the world since May that has lined up behind this with U.S.-Russia policy, U.S.-Russia interaction, U.S.-Russia in Syria, since this event supposedly took place. And you begin to find that there's a whole lot of dynamic that has happened in the aftermath of that you know, as people have been just, you know, bloviating to no end over events of the world, have missed out on a whole lot that happens and plays out on a global stage. And it does, by the way. It happens all the time. But this just moves them closer to the return of their Messiah.
Should we get the next few games to take them out?
Well, they're not there yet. I mean, they're not there yet.
Find the lines of secession, take them out, and get them back with.
Yes, Pete.
Where do you find reliable information about things like this? You can find. I mean, how much do you have to sift through to find something you think is at least close to what the truth is?
I don't know. I mean, the stuff I'm sharing with you, you know, comes out of news reports. And I tell you that. I mean, I tell you the front end. It's reported, and this is it, and that's what somebody says here. You know, but you know, it's funny because we did put this online, and even as soon as we put online. As I predicted, people hear this through their politics, right? Oh, my gosh. You know, I don't know how they had time to listen to all the crap we put out there, stuff we put out there. But they have already. You know, and I'm like, don't read into it any more than I said. I mean, you know, if you listen, you know, I'm an equal opportunity offender, I suppose. You know, because, I mean, you know, I've thrown both parties under the bus at this point. If you're, you know, if you're a political person, I've thrown every network under the bus, I think, as we kind of studied this thing now for umpteen weeks. But Pete, that's a great question. I don't know. When I hear something on these, I'm just a cynic at the front end of it. I just don't believe most of it. You know, like, who said this? Where did it come from? Let's see. Usually I don't start believing or really paying attention to it until it kind of goes down, you know, two or three more reports and it starts filtering out as to what, you know, where does it come from? Because even I am convinced that the front line of the war against ISIS happens from the Muslim community. But it's not happening. Which is why we continue to lose ground. Which is why also then, you know, we get into such a... when I say this, we get into very tricky geopolitical and cultural issues, because you start asking the question, well, why? You know, why aren't you hearing leaders, a lot of leaders, in Muslim environments come out and just speak out against this? Why are they not at the front line of this fight? Why are they not counteracting some of the indoctrination and training? Because the silence sometimes is deafening. But then you start asking the question, why? You know, and then you start getting that gray area. Then you start making and forming your own conclusions. You're trying to understand the tough to understand. And then for America, the politics gets in the way, because it doesn't take long, and now we're in a civil rights discussion. You know, we're in privacy discussions. We're in, you know, and so, you know, so the answer to your question is, don't believe most of what you hear. I mean, I that's all I know to tell you. I mean, but I am convinced, and I've said this many, many times, I am convinced that there has not been to this point a very well, clear, defined strategy against ISIS. Just because we don't fight that war, right? I mean, you know, I got an email this week, you know, saying, well, how do you win? You know, and I said, there's a variety of ways to win, but none of them sit very comfortably with anybody I know that follows Jesus. You know, because, I mean, don't kid yourself. The United States has the firepower to defeat ISIS. We could do it. Is there a high cost? Yeah. I mean, what happens to the Ahmed Hunt? No one knows. You know, and that's part of the problem. And probably one of the reasons that we don't fight it very well is because we have failed strategically to ever understand what happens in the aftermath of what we do as we deal with ISIS or terrorism. Because, again, go back to the simple illustrations. You kill Osama bin Laden, and everyone's like, oh, we did it. We did what? I mean, when I take inventory and look, nothing's better since Osama bin Laden's gone, and 2 weeks ago they moved back into his compound again. The compound where we took him out, where what's-his-name, you know, fired that shot that has become famous, terrorists now have retaken that compound again. Which, again, very much under the radar of most people that, you know, listen to the news. So, we don't have a good end plan. And so I think part of the problem is, you try to fight a conventional war where you think there's going to be a day that there's a peace treaty signed, and that's how it ends. We go back to the biblical view of this. I don't see anything biblically that leads me to believe that there's a peace treaty ever coming in this war. Which ought to beg the better question, which I think is the good question. Oh, man, we're out of time. Which is the good question, is this the last war? Ah. According to David Jeremiah, it is.
You mean Armageddon?
No, not Armageddon. Okay. But I mean the last war before that final conflict. Okay. I mean, is this the final war that's going to play out on the world stage? According to him, it is. Are there guys that are saying this one is it, and the way we're finding it, this is going to be the battle of not our lifetime, but of the lifetime of everyone until the end. Yeah. And there are some that think that it is. Now, I don't know if I agree with that or not, but it could be. I mean, it certainly could be. It's tough. I mean, it's tricky stuff. Next week, I want to give to you what are, I think, some as followers, what we need to understand about the defeat of ISIS. Not that there's a biblical model to defeat ISIS, okay? There's not a biblical model to defeat ISIS. The biblical model would be what you know it's supposed to be. If they came to know Jesus, they don't fight. Right, okay, yes, that is the given. But again, so is evangelism the strategy to defeat ISIS? I hope it's not for our government. Okay, I mean, I hope there's nobody in Washington going, let's evangelize them. Let's love them like Jesus loved them. It's going to be okay. I hope no one is thinking that. So only that is it. But there are some ways that we as followers can view it that help us understand. But then I believe that there are some practical things that are emerging right now that are strategic ways to start undercutting, if you will, the influence of ISIS that to this point we have not done, if that makes any sense. And they're fairly new. We actually have somebody right now who has some political clout and a voice where they can give voice to it that I think is pretty solid in some ways, and in some ways maybe not so much, but interesting. And you may have seen him on the news. Sebastian Gorka is his name. But has some very strong, clear-minded approaches that need to take place. And we'll talk about that. And then we'll talk about Russia. How about that? That's a lot. Maybe. Let's pray. God, you are good to us. And we end this time together just as we started. Boy, we live in a complicated world. And that complicated world reminds us of just how much we need you. It can be scary. It can be scary to watch the news. It can be scary to think about all the things that are happening around us. It can be scary about how we feel as we try to move and live our lives in a way that, for the most part, this barely impacts us at all some days. And it's very real. And it's playing out in this world that you created. And there's a need for us to at least have some understanding of it so we know how to pray, so we know how to process, and so we can live and not have to live in fear. And so, God, I pray that as we continue and wrap up this study next week, that maybe we would find some ways to hang on to some things that would help us. And be with us now as we move to a time of worship and think of the bigness and the greatness of who you are. In Jesus' name, amen.